2003. Along the way, he'd become a subtle thinker about foundations and saw their CEOs as leaders who manage key tensions within the institution. There is a natural tension, Canalis told me, between constancy and change, having staying power on a set of issues, but also taking on new things. As well, there's a tension between tackling urgent challenges and having a long-term perspective. A foundation needs to be focused and strategic, Canalis believes, but also flexible. When he was first approached about the bar job in 2013, Canalis wasn't interested. He was happy at Irvine and a lifetime native of San Francisco. Canalis had grown up in the city in a lower middle-class family with divorced parents. His father was a cab driver, his mother a waitress. He was raised mainly by his great-grandmother, who was from Nicaragua and spoke only Spanish. As a student at a Jesuit high school, Canalis got interested in public service, but even through college and graduate school at Stanford, he never aspired to work in foundations. I don't think it's necessarily a career path that one thinks about. Oh, I'm going to become a professional philanthropist. Few young people, and indeed few Americans, know the first thing about the rarefied realm of grant-making. Canalis went into teaching after Stanford and in his mid-20s stumbled into a job at Irvine by accident through a connection with its president, Dennis Collins, who hired him as a special assistant in 1993. Within 10 years, after holding several positions at Irvine, Canalis was running the place. Beyond feeling settled in his life in the Bay Area, Canalis wasn't interested in the bar job because he'd heard stories about the difficulties of working with living donors or family members. Over half of all U.S. foundations are controlled by families, and crazy is how one veteran consultant described to me the dynamics at some of these institutions. Canalis was more diplomatic, a trait he's known for, referring obliquely to the history and the relationships that exist at foundations controlled by living donors and or their heirs. He preferred working in a more professionalized setting where there aren't other layers or agendas or relationships at play. Still, Canalis agreed to meet the Hostetters for lunch when the couple was on a visit to San Francisco to offer advice about Barr's governance. During that conversation, and in more talks that followed through the fall of 2013, Canalis found the Hostetters thoughtful and strategic, and grew excited about their vision. For one thing, they didn't want Barr to be a family foundation. Rather, their goal was to gradually expand the board, beyond just the two of them, to include a majority of outsiders. Barr's new president would be the first addition, and that was a second thing that excited Canalis. The Hostetters were really looking for a partner, one who could take the foundation to the next stage, past its adolescence, as Barbara described it. The Hostetters also liked Canalis, with his seasoned views on how foundations should operate. The couple had been funding in the same core areas for many years and weren't looking for a radical makeover. What they wanted was a more strategic foundation that delivered higher impact, but in a style consistent with how the Hostetters had long operated. Here, too, the couple felt confident about Canalis. His values are akin to our own, Barbara would tell a reporter. He believes in humility and collaboration and partnerships in philanthropy. Given Barr's big footprint in Boston's civic life, these values aren't just a matter of personal taste. They help reduce the chance that the foundation's growing local power will invite a backlash. After all, who are Amos and Barbara Hostetter, whatever their good intentions, to have so much influence in a city that led the way in rejecting dynastic rule by Britain's royal family? The more Canalis thought about leading Barr, the more he was drawn to the idea. It was really about building something, he told me. It wasn't a startup, but it was about taking something to its next level as an institution. Canalis's husband, a doctor, would have plenty of opportunities in Boston with its many hospitals. So finally, Canalis said yes. A press release announcing the hire said he would lead a strategic planning process to explore how Barr might grow over time, leveraging its local work, taking good ideas to scale, and extending its impact regionally, nationally, and internationally. His salary was $700,000 a year, a nice bump up from what he'd been making at Irvine. As it turned out, Canalis' first order of business after arriving at Barr in 2014 was streamlining its work, not expanding it. Foundations can evolve haphazardly in their early years, especially if the donors behind them circulate widely and aren't good at saying no. Also, once a nonprofit starts getting support and comes to rely on that money, it becomes hard to cut the cord. Grantees can accumulate over time, spreading a foundation too thin and dissipating its impact. By the time Canalis arrived at Barr, it seemed as though it was funding every major nonprofit in Boston, sometimes without a strong strategy driving that blizzard of grants. The foundation had also started a global program, jumping into a vast new area. Canalis launched a planning process aimed at getting a handle on things. The global work was the first to go, with that program soon shutting its doors. As the internal discussions went on, Barr decided to really double down on Boston and New England rather than expand nationally. That was an important choice and a disciplined one, since many funders hanker to operate on a grand stage where they can shape federal policy. Even with over $1 billion in assets, though, the Hostetters and Canalis saw that the foundation would likely have a larger impact by remaining a big fish in a small pond. The streamlining continued. Barr was especially overextended in its education giving, and Canalis worked to sharpen the focus in that area. Here, he said, we really did take a step back. We wanted to see if there was some particular zone where Barr could have a unique impact. The new strategic plan called for helping young people develop the skills and critical thinking needed to succeed in future careers, a grant-making strategy Canalis had earlier brought to Irvine. As Barr's planning was wrapping up, Canalis wrote in a blog post that education would be the area of biggest transition for the foundation. That kind of language strikes terror in grantees, and sure enough, some education-related nonprofits that had long gotten Barr grants soon discovered that this support would be winding down, another phrase that stalks the nightmares of nonprofit executives. The foundation world is famously genteel, even as strong disagreements roil beneath the surface. Canalis embodies that civility, and he wielded a scalpel and anesthesia, not a meat cleaver, as he streamlined and professionalized Barr. As a foundation lifer, Canalis also exhibits the cautious instincts that philanthropoids often are criticized for. The new Barr, like the old, wouldn't be gunning for disruptive or systemic changes. Instead, Canalis talks soothingly about the foundation's melding the roles of steward and catalyst, language that very much reflects the Hostetters' sensibilities. That approach might not yield the kind of big near-term impacts that many younger funders aim for these days, but it's attuned to the downsides of billionaires treating society as guinea pigs as they throw around money in search of breakthroughs. While new, entrepreneurial funders talk with pride about their willingness to take risks, veteran funders like Canalis know that such risk-taking can jerk people around. At one point, Canalis wrote a blog post saying that, while Barr embraced risk, it was mindful that screw-ups by the foundation could burden the very people it is our mission to serve. To Canalis's careful way of thinking, the key in pushing the envelope is balance. Another difference between Barr and a place like the Arnold Foundation is that it's being designed to exist in perpetuity. This choice tends to be more common among donors who are loyal to a place, as the Hostetters are to Boston, where presumably extra resources to address problems will always come in handy. The perpetuity model also syncs up with the couple's stewardship view of philanthropy, one that stresses the need to nurture key institutions and people over long periods of time. This model means that Barr will be limited in its ability to place truly big bets, since it has to husband its resources. But perpetuity offers a path to influence that's compelling in its own way. In decades to come, or centuries, Barr's endowment is likely to grow many times. The Hostetters may be powerful in Boston today, but long after they are gone, their money might be speaking even more loudly in the city and region than it does now. In effect, Barr is immortal. Legacy. In the 1990s, when he had a net worth of several billion dollars, George Soros, already a major philanthropist, often said that he wouldn't leave a foundation behind when he died. Soros shared the common fear that such institutions tended to grow bureaucratic and ineffective. His goal was to give away all his money during his lifetime, or even sooner, at one point saying that he'd wind up his philanthropy by 2010. This turned out to be overly ambitious, even as Soros gave away more and more money, with grants going to every part of the world. He kept getting richer at an even faster rate. His legendary Quantum Fund averaged annual returns of over 25%. By 2005, with a net worth of $7 billion, Soros announced at his 75th birthday party that he wouldn't try to give away all his money after all and would leave a foundation behind. It was a wise decision, since a decade later, even with Soros' annual giving running over $900 million a year, his fortune had grown larger still to $24 billion. Soros' sprawling Open Society Foundations, OSF, is the largest and most complex foundation ever created. It has branches in 37 countries and is involved in an endless array of issues. Although Soros is best known for his activities in the former communist bloc, his foundation now operates throughout Africa, as well as in the Middle East, Latin America, and parts of Asia. OSF also funds throughout the United States. Soros started giving in the late 1970s and greatly stepped things up in the 1980s as he sought to weaken totalitarian rule in the Soviet bloc. Once communism collapsed, he pivoted to the next challenge of making sure the new nations that arose embraced the ideals of an open society, which to Soros meant that everyone should be heard in public life and no one should have a monopoly on the truth. In 1993, Soros hired Arya Nair to run his foundation and to lead its expansion into other parts of the world too, including the United States. For nearly 20 years, Nair and Soros were a dynamic duo, divvying up the planet's problems, with Soros charting OSF's work on economic development and higher education, while Nair, who had co-founded Human Rights Watch, took point on rights and political development. Together, the two men built a formidable philanthropic organization, but one also known for its fragmentation and maddening jerry-rigged qualities. Outsiders found it hard to understand the place. Grantees and staff often had the same complaint. Even board members didn't always know where grant money was going. In fact, no single board had full authority over the entire foundation. Soros knew there was a problem, and when he named a new president in 2011, after Nair retired, he told the New York Times, "We have a very complex organization. It has become too complicated, and it needs to be streamlined to become more unified." The stakes were high in taming OSF. Soros, now in his 80s, wouldn't be around forever, and it was critical to build a foundation where he wasn't the glue holding things together. One bleak scenario was that Soros's far-flung philanthropic operation could splinter after he dies. "It could be like the former Yugoslavia," a former OSF executive told me. The larger picture was that Soros's life work of advancing open society wasn't going so well. During the 1990s, Soros had been widely celebrated for his foundation's role in bringing down communism and encouraging the spread of democracy. By the early 21st century, though, history was moving in the opposite direction, with many countries led by authoritarian rulers. In the former Soviet bloc, OSF grantees were coming under new pressure from repressive regimes. Hard-fought gains by the foundation were slipping away. Soros, who became more active in his foundation after retiring from his hedge fund, had no intention of ceding the fight in whatever time he had left. The new president of OSF was Chris Stone, whom Soros called an outsider insider. Stone had come to know OSF well as both a grantee working on criminal justice reform and an advisor to the foundation. When he was tapped to lead OSF, he was teaching at Harvard's Kennedy School, and he came across more as a brainy academic than as the guy you'd hire to wrangle an organizational octopus, much less to go up against, say, the thugs who run Turkmenistan. But Stone was a seasoned nonprofit leader who earlier ran the Vera Institute of Justice, and while at Harvard, had spent much time thinking about management as director of the Hauser Center on Nonprofit Organizations. Stone's mission at OSF was to build a foundation that, as he told me, was working with a meaningful budget, designed to advance a meaningful strategy that is clear and expressed, which the board had a meaningful role in shaping. While those goals were elementary, they'd be a huge step forward for a foundation well known for its creative chaos, and they'd ensure that OSF could carry forth Soros' vision when Soros himself was no longer active. That vision has always included a strong appetite for policy combat, along with a willingness to engage in controversial causes that other funders steer clear of. For example, no philanthropist has done more than Soros to soften America's drug laws. Soros got behind that cause in the mid-1990s, funding a new drug policy think tank and bankrolling the push for medical marijuana, widely seen as a bridge to legalization. Today, 2 decades after Soros began his push, and many tens of millions of dollars later, several states have legalized pot, and more are likely to follow. OSF was also the first major foundation to get behind same-sex marriage. From 2000 to 2005, a pivotal period in the marriage equality fight, OSF invested millions in LGBT rights organizations. This early money, some of which went to back state-level fights, like a 2005 legal challenge in Iowa, was arguably more important than the bigger money that came in from other funders later on. OSF grants also went to frontline activist groups fighting for immigrants and later to Black Lives Matter. As early as 1996, before Soros had become a boogeyman of the American right, the New York Times would write, "While other foundations and philanthropists are more comfortable healing the sick, housing the poor, or feeding the hungry, Mr. Soros is unabashed in pursuing a political agenda." The Times described Soros as a billionaire who redefines charity. But it couldn't have predicted just how influential his model would come to be over the next 2 decades. In some ways, Soros's activist giving marked the start of today's modern era of big philanthropy by living donors. OSF's biggest focus has always been overseas, where it's backed efforts to attack government corruption, support dissidents, and champion the right of persecuted minorities, like the Roma of Europe and the Rohingya of Burma. It's funded Palestinian groups challenging Israeli policies in the occupied territories and financed a long-running effort to combat the immense graft and abuses around extractive industries such as oil. Endless grants have flowed to youth activists, human rights lawyers, and documentary filmmakers. At some point or another, nearly every justice and rights group on almost every continent has gotten OSF money. And the plan, as George Soros faced his mortality, was to keep that spigot open forever. Embracing a perpetuity model, OSF would be a lifeline for contrarian voices until, potentially, the end of time. Soros had never endowed his foundation. It was always a pay-as-you-go operation, which is not uncommon among living donors. Soros preferred to keep his money in his hedge fund, which kept scoring huge gains even after he officially retired. In 2013, the first year after Soros stepped down from actively running it, his fund, now basically an outsized family office led by his son Robert, returned gains of 24%. Soros himself made $4 billion that year. While Soros has not signed the giving pledge, Chris Stone said that the board and staff have every expectation that the bulk of his fortune will be left, one way or the other, to the foundation, and we are building an organization capable of governing and deploying that resource as responsibly as possible to fulfill his mission. Assuming all goes as planned, though, OSF will someday have one of the biggest foundation endowments in the world. After 3 years in what was surely one of the toughest jobs in philanthropy, Stone had made good progress toward unifying OSF and streamlining its operations. The foundation has put in place a stronger system of board governance, as well as a unified budgetary process. Soros himself was more involved with the foundation than he had been in years, talking with Stone nearly every day and traveling to the foundation's local offices. Even in his mid-80s, Soros thought nothing of setting off to Ukraine or some other faraway place to see for himself what was happening. Still, Soros didn't micromanage Stone and remained committed to the long-term shift of authority to OSF's governing board. While his children sat on that board, they didn't have a majority voice. The idea was that the post-Soros OSF would be run by a collection of eminent leaders, not the Soros family. After Stone's hard labor, the foundation was still a place where, occasionally, the left hand didn't know what the right hand was doing. But those days were coming to an end. For all its past achievements, OSF was being bolstered and reshaped to possibly wield even more influence in coming decades, and maybe for centuries beyond. Endgame. Not long before George Soros abandoned his quest to give away his fortune while still living, Chuck Feeney got serious about doing exactly that. In 1984, Feeney had transferred all his business assets to his foundation, the Atlantic Philanthropies, which operated anonymously for years with a small staff. In 2002, the foundation announced it would cease all grant-making within a finite period of time, 2016 to be exact. At the time, its endowment stood at $3.5 billion, which was hardly an insurmountable amount of money to dump overboard. Flash forward to 2015, with the clock ticking down, Atlantic still had hundreds of millions to dispose of. And the man charged with getting rid of the money, Chris Oxley, Atlantic's CEO, was under a lot of stress. "To do this well is not an easy job," he told me. By this time, Atlantic had long ago emerged from the shadows, and Feeney himself had become an iconic figure in modern philanthropy. He'd been the subject of a biography, The Billionaire Who Wasn't, and of numerous articles about the odd rich guy trying to go broke, as Forbes put it. For years, Feeney had stood out as an evangelist for giving while living, in his catchy phrase. "I see little reason to delay giving when so much good can be achieved through supporting worthwhile causes today," Feeney once said. Now that same logic was being widely embraced by many new funders, especially in the tech world. Young philanthropists like Dustin Moskovitz and Sean Parker share Feeney's belief that a donor could have the most impact by front-loading their giving in the form of big bets, and that foundations were most effective when the clock was ticking. Tim Gill, the LGBT funder, is also among those tech funders who have set a sunset date for his foundation. "If you're talking about social change, your objective should be to improve the lives of people as dramatically and as soon as possible," Gill told me. His husband, Scott Miller, added, "It's given us the mindset that we need to act fast. These foundations that go on in perpetuity, where do they get a sense of urgency?" The Gill Foundation's own impatient, forward-looking posture is a key reason it's been so effective at advancing LGBT rights faster than anyone had once thought possible. Eli Broad is another funder who's been in a hurry and can't think of any reason to leave the job of giving away his billions to someone else. He told me, "If you have the resources and you have the talent, you should use it, rather than leaving it in a foundation with people who don't have any idea of what the founder wanted." The debate between continuing in perpetuity and spending down sooner is almost as old as modern philanthropy itself, although it's been getting a lot more attention lately as new funders sort out their plans. At one of the annual convenings of the Giving Pledge members, the staff organized a panel that featured voices on either side of this issue. Long before Feeney popularized giving while living, the early 20th century philanthropist Julius Rosenwald preached the same gospel with a remarkably similar slogan, "Give while you live." The founder of Sears Roebuck, Rosenwald's name is now largely forgotten precisely because he didn't emulate contemporaries like John D. Rockefeller and Andrew Carnegie in creating a permanent foundation. Yet Rosenwald may have had as much impact as either philanthropist because of what he did do, which was to sink a lot of his fortune into helping build 5,300 schools for black children throughout the South. It was the kind of huge upfront capital investment that a more cautious foundation, mindful of preserving its endowment, would never have made. But Rosenwald's cash and boldness had a transformative effect on African-American chances in the Jim Crow South, where his schools educated the likes of John Lewis, who helped lead the civil rights movement long after Rosenwald was gone. Chuck Feeney never found a leverage point quite that profound, but the staff at Atlantic was very focused on systemic change, and the imperative to spend down meant that they had resources to put lots of money behind bold efforts to redirect public policy and society. In 2009, Atlantic became the single biggest backer of hard-hitting advocacy to help enact the Affordable Care Act, with a $27 million gift to the progressive coalition Health Care for America Now, HCON. That grant was made by Gary LaMarche, the foundation's CEO at the time, who'd perfected the art of using money to shape policy during his many years leading George Soros's U.S. giving. Chris Oxley, who succeeded LaMarche in 2011 as Atlantic CEO, had spent time in the U.S. Senate as a top aide to Democrat Russ Feingold. His main background, though, was in business, as well as in working with Feeney and Atlantic over many years. Oxley found the job of winding down Atlantic difficult not just because the clock was ticking ever more loudly by 2015, but because the foundation had grand ambitions for how to deploy its final millions. It aimed to make a series of big, culminating grants to nonprofits that could keep achieving important gains long after Atlantic was gone. What Oxley called champion organizations. According to one planning document, Atlantic's goal was to build on its previous grant-making with the hope of catalyzing transformative systemic change in the fields and countries where it had worked for years, including the United States. The overall aim of such change was greater equity and to enhance opportunity for people who have unfairly been denied that opportunity, Oxley said. The culminating grants would be on the order of $10 million to $20 million, the kind of money that most nonprofit CEOs could never even dream of getting. But how would Atlantic decide which groups got these transformative gifts? There are more champions than we could possibly support, Oxley sighed. But we're trying really hard to identify those institutions that can make a lasting impact. That challenge of who to bet on is a familiar one for foundation CEOs. Few such executives, though, had ever faced such an intense deadline for deciding where to put their chips. It's complicated and stressful, Oxley told me. Some choices were easy. A large culminating grant went to the ACLU, which was founded nearly a century earlier and was widely admired by funders for its skill at engaging legal and policy contests. Atlantic's big infusion of cash, $10 million, would specifically aim to bolster the ACLU's advocacy powers, including at the state level, where so many key issues were decided. Another culminating grant went to the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, for over 30 years a stalwart defender of U.S. government programs to aid the poor. Few Beltway groups had done more to beat back conservative efforts to drown government in the bathtub, as Grover Norquist famously put it. Yet the center did have a major weakness. It had never been very good at generating new policy ideas or reframing debates over the long term. It was more of a finger-in-the-dike operation than an effort to redirect the river, which is what places like Heritage and Cato were focused on. Atlantic's huge grant aimed to help the center do a better job playing offense, promoting new ways to reduce poverty as opposed to just blocking the latest round of draconian cuts. To transform America's healthcare system in a more equitable way, Atlantic gave a culminating grant to Community Catalyst, a Boston-based group known for its advocacy of progressive healthcare policies, including its extensive work to help implement the Affordable Care Act in the face of fierce GOP opposition. The money would fund a new push to empower consumers using the health system. Much of it would go for investments in advocacy and leadership. Separately, Atlantic gave over $1 million to Community Catalyst's 501c4 arm, which could engage more directly in political battles. Atlantic's big grants kept flowing through 2015 and into 2016, when it announced $200 million in investments to create a community of leaders that can promote equity on a global scale. Nearly half of that money went to establish a new Atlantic Fellows program at the London School of Economics and Political Science. The larger half, $106 million, was a 15-year grant to create the Atlantic Institute, which the foundation said will be a nexus for the fellows to collaborate as they work to make the world a better place. "Change is always about people," Oxley told me about this new effort, launched as the foundation got ready to finally wrap up its grant-making. The idea, he said, is to create a community of actors that will have a big impact on equity challenges worldwide. Oxley said, "Atlantic hoped to help shift the global narrative on this issue, retelling the story about what's unfair and biased." That's a lofty goal, even for a funder as aggressive as Atlantic. Will Feeney's billions ultimately have as much impact as Julius Rosenwald did, or as contemporaries like George Soros do? It's too early to say, but it's hard to recall a more urgent quest for influence than Atlantic's spend-down push over the past decade. In 1910, when Edward Devine argued that the proposed Rockefeller Foundation should have to abide by certain constraints, one of them was a limited lifespan. He said the foundation should have to dissolve after 100 years. That idea, along with a limit on the foundation's size and a public role on selecting its trustees, was incorporated into a bill put before the U.S. Congress in 1911. Such was the hostility to Rockefeller, though, and the fears of a powerful foundation, that Congress rejected the proposal. The Rockefeller Foundation would later be incorporated in New York State with none of the conditions that Devine had proposed. Nor would such stipulations be applied to the tens of thousands of foundations that were subsequently created. Today's critics of philanthropy fixate often on perpetuity, which some see as prime evidence that foundations are accountable to no one, not even, eventually, to the people who created them. Rather, they become shadowy entities on autopilot, amassing ever greater wealth and wielding enormous clout even as they answer only to themselves. All that may be true, but forcing foundations to spend down is hardly a way to limit the influence of private money over public life. On the contrary, as we've seen, living donors in a hurry can be far more aggressive in trying to reshape public policy. If all philanthropists were compelled to act as Chuck Feeney has, it's likely that philanthropy's influence in U.S. society would actually be much greater. That could be a good thing, to the extent that more resources are focused on big problems, like climate change or poverty. Or it could be a bad thing, as public debates increasingly become a clash of philanthropic titans with ordinary Americans sitting on the sidelines. As for which model of giving the majority of new donors will actually embrace, that remains to be seen. The spend-down approach is certainly popular right now, especially among younger tech philanthropists like Mark Zuckerberg. Down the line, though, as these donors find out how hard it is to unload big money quickly and effectively, they may revisit the idea of leaving behind foundations, just as George Soros did. Whatever the case, one thing is clear. It's not just the new philanthropists who are wielding more power these days. It is those they are deputizing to dispose of their wealth, a group whose ranks are fast expanding as more foundations are born and grow. In coming decades, this segment of America's elite class will loom ever larger in national life. Epilogue. Balancing Act. In the summer of 2015, a fierce debate played out in Washington, D.C. and across the media over a proposed deal to curtail Iran's nuclear program. It was hard to recall a foreign policy fight quite like this one, with donors opening their checkbooks to finance millions of dollars in advertisements, lobbying efforts, and policy reports aimed at shaping not just what Congress did, but how elites and the public thought about the deal. Just how much money were we talking about? Nobody could say for sure, and they still can't, since the nonprofits leading the charge on both sides don't have to reveal the identity of their donors or the amounts they gave. But estimates ranged in the tens of millions of dollars, with a good chunk of that anonymous money flowing through 501c4 groups that oppose the deal, like Citizens for a Nuclear-Free Iran. In this way, the Iran fight was another reminder of the lax regulation of nonprofits, even as they have become ever more powerful bullhorns for wealthy donors. This doesn't seem quite what Alexis de Tocqueville had in mind when he famously opined about how U.S. civil society gave voice to the everyman. To be sure, nonprofits still do that, and in myriad ways, but there's been a big change in recent decades in who's orchestrating public conversations. The mass membership organizations of earlier eras, which were fueled by the dues of ordinary citizens, have become less important, while wealthy philanthropists have grown more numerous and empowered. This shift has occurred alongside a parallel shift in electoral politics, where the donor class has come to wield greater clout as political parties have declined and voter turnout has remained anemic. The swollen river of money coming into America's democracy has drawn attention for years. Less understood is how philanthropic dollars make up a key tributary in that river, often helping set the agenda on key policy issues well before they come onto the radar of elected officials or voters. The Iran nuclear debate showcased that. Years of tax-deductible gifts to think tanks and advocacy groups helped to shape the larger terms of the Iran debate long before negotiators reached a final deal. For example, scholars at the American Enterprise Institute, heavily backed by Wall Street donors, had endlessly pounded the point in op-eds, congressional testimony, and TV appearances that Iran couldn't be trusted, as did other outfits like the Center for Security Policy. On the other side, the peace group Plowshares, backed by foundations and major donors, played a key behind-the-scenes role in pushing forward U.S.-Iran dialogue, starting in the early 2000s. The Rockefeller Brothers Fund was among the top funders of this work, a reminder of the long reach of old money into current debates. Another key player was J Street, which describes itself as the political home for pro-Israel, pro-peace Americans who want Israel to be secure, and was founded in 2007. Bringing a less hawkish Jewish voice to debates over the Middle East, J Street would emerge as a leading proponent of the deal with Iran, acting as a counterweight to the more conservative American-Israel Political Action Committee, AIPAC, which had long dominated Beltway debates over Israel's security. Like so many policy groups these days, J Street is a hybrid creature. It is a 501c4 that has a 501c3 arm, the J Street Education Fund, which can receive philanthropic contributions. It also has a political action committee, J Street PAC. J Street's breadth was a crucial asset in the Iran debate. When the finalized nuclear deal reached Washington, heavy political spending through 501c4s, PACs, and lobbying firms took center stage amid efforts to influence lawmakers, even as J Street kept pumping out policy analysis. That kind of tag-team influence push is common these days, as we've seen in other areas, education, LGBT rights, climate change, donors who care deeply about causes often work all the levers they can to press their agenda. Meanwhile, the rest of us can write our congressional representatives, or maybe start a petition. When it comes to who gets heard in the public square, ordinary citizens can't begin to compete with an activist donor class that has grown exponentially in the new Gilded Age. Grassroots movements like the Tea Party or Occupy Wall Street can and do spring up to wield strong influence at certain moments, but on a day-to-day basis, the deck is stacked in favor of those who have the money to amplify their voices. This helps explain why so many Americans have disengaged from civic life. Why bother? At least with the Iran nuclear deal, there was a clear entry point for average voters, given that Congress had a say in the deal. Often, though, philanthropists are shaping agendas in ways that never entail a roll call vote by elected representatives. That's especially true as funders expand their role in areas where government leadership is waning, such as creating new schools, building public parks, setting the priorities of state university systems, and funding scientific research. Many of the things philanthropists are doing are inspiring, depending on your point of view, and it's hard to argue with new resources and imagination at a moment when government seems less able to solve problems because of either a lack of political will or money. Still, the overall picture here is unsettling. Private funders have been pushing more energetically into public life even as many ordinary people have been withdrawing. And even as a key means by which citizens do things together, government is foundering. It can be tempting to blame the wealthy for this situation, reinforcing a neat narrative about creeping plutocracy. And for sure, some elements of the far upper class have pushed hard for an America where government is smaller and weaker, while philanthropy and business call more of the shots. Since the 1970s, wealthy donors have heavily financed efforts to cut taxes and public spending. The success they've had helps explain why government now can't do as many things, which gives private funders new leverage in shaping society. It's hardly far-fetched to think we've witnessed a brilliant power grab. First, the wealthy helped knock out government. Now, they're taking more direct charge of society themselves, using philanthropy as one tool. Yet, if you get to know wealthy donors, you'll quickly realize that most don't think in sweeping terms like this. Instead, they're focused on solving specific problems, and they tend to think in practical ways about how to do that. Their engagement in policy and politics often comes reluctantly, with many steering clear of this area for fear of controversy. Also, quite a few of today's philanthropists are prone to see government more as a partner than as an enemy. In fact, many believe in expanding government's role, whether to protect the environment or civil rights, or to help more poor kids go to college. Many would happily pay higher taxes. There is no plutocratic plot behind today's big philanthropy, at least not that I've uncovered. Very few of the new donors are doing anything sinister. You may or may not agree with the ends they seek, but their means reflect a feature of our society that has made it better and stronger since Tocqueville's day. That said, we still have a problem. That an ever larger and richer upper class is amplifying its influence through large-scale giving in an era when it already has too much clout. Things are going to get worse, too. Which is why now is a good moment to reform philanthropy so that it's more aligned with American values, and especially the egalitarian ethos so core to our national identity. Who's getting heard? Economic inequality has risen sharply in the past four decades, and in some ways, philanthropy's fingerprints are all over this trend. Waves of funders, as we've seen, have donated billions to push economic policies that favor the owners of capital and to downsize government programs for lower-income Americans. In other ways, though, philanthropy has fought inequality by defending the social safety net, helping the poor build assets, promoting universal health insurance, paying for college scholarships, and much more. Overall, the net impact of philanthropy in regard to economic inequality seems limited. The story on civic inequality is quite different and troubling. Here, we find a glass more half empty than full. Philanthropy has famously helped enfranchise marginalized groups starting in the 1950s and still finances a large legal and advocacy infrastructure to advance the rights of minorities, women, and LGBT Americans. It has also worked to offset the clout of corporate interests, like the fossil fuel industry. Yet much of what we've seen in this book suggests that philanthropy now acts as a driver of the growing divide in America in who gets heard in the public square, along with who sets the agenda, both nationally and locally. Giving by the wealthy is amplifying their voice at the expense of ordinary citizens, complementing other tools of upper-class dominance. Not everyone agrees with that analysis or worries about this trend. One line of thought is that funders put their money behind so many different causes that such giving more or less tracks with the overall diversity of viewpoints in America. Philanthropy doesn't act as one voice and one actor, John Arnold told me. There are many different philanthropists, many different foundations that have different ideologies, different philosophies, different interests, and they are all trying to win in the marketplace of ideas. This competition, the logic goes, helps amplify an informed public debate and strengthens pluralism and democracy. This is civil society flourishing, the scholar Paul Skirvish told me in discussing the recent upsurge in activist philanthropy backed by the wealthy. A number of philanthropists told me the same thing, that their giving was opening up debates, not shutting them down. I certainly heard this argument in regard to K-12 education, an area that sparked the most alarm about private funders meddling in public life. As donors like Eli Broad tell the story, their philanthropy has finally created a real debate over how to improve schools after decades in which the education establishment and teachers' unions squelched certain kinds of ideas and experiments, enforcing what Broad has called a tired government monopoly. The rise of J Street is another example of donors broadening public debates. The days when AIPAC dominated discussion of Israel inside the Beltway are now over, thanks partly to philanthropists like George Skoll and Soros. One can think of plenty of other places, such as drug policy, where funders have expanded the range of views that are getting heard. Another defense of philanthropy is that government isn't so good at exploring new ideas and taking risks. Precisely because it is a democratic institution, beholden to fickle voters with limited patience, government can be a weak tool for tackling certain challenges that are critical to the public interest. There are absolute constraints on what a political entity can do, just because of the nature of how politicians are elected and the incentive systems that most politicians have, John Arnold told me. So it's good to have some small amounts of money that are outside of political oversight. Arnold went on to add that ultimately, the check on the system is you still have to convince the political system that a certain idea is better and should be adopted. That is the correct and reasonable check. In other words, representatives elected by citizens still make the final decisions. Bill Gates has said the same thing, presenting his foundation as an R&D shop that engages in experiments that government can't or won't fund and thus expands the pool of ideas available to decision makers. He's insisted that our voice is not there when the final choice of what to scale up is made. That's a governor or a superintendent or a board of education that decide those things. Meanwhile, it's often said that philanthropy boosts civic equality by empowering voices that would otherwise be bulldozed aside by business interests. Recall how Chuck Feeney gave millions to ensure that advocates of the Affordable Care Act had a fighting chance against industry opponents. Philanthropists also stress that it's not their ideas that are being heard, it's that of their grantees. Mark and I aren't in some ivory tower making up all these strategies on our own, Priscilla Chan told me. We are deeply connected to experts. We are in touch with the front lines. We are amplifying the voices of the people who are doing great work out there. The claim that philanthropy advances pluralism is largely persuasive, but pluralism is not the same as civic equality. While philanthropists may support lots of different views and ideas, we're still talking about an America where public debates have become heavily choreographed by wealthy actors without real constituencies. The Gates and Arnold Foundations may very well do an excellent job of teeing up new ideas that get a hearing in our political system. That's different, though, from such ideas percolating upward by more democratic means. These foundations, controlled by billionaire couples and answerable to no one, have put themselves in an influential position to shape what moves higher on the to-do list of public officials. Yes, elected leaders make the final call on which ideas get enacted, but their power, exercised at the end of the policy-making funnel, may actually matter less than what's being fed into the front of the funnel. In the case of the Gates Foundation, which has dangled many millions of dollars before school districts to enact certain policies, the hard power of the purse has supplemented the soft power of ideas. Agenda setting by wealthy donors might not matter so much if their views truly tracked with those of the general public. But the wealthy really are different from other Americans in their ideology. They are more fiscally conservative and socially liberal than the population as a whole. They have a stronger belief in market solutions and technocratic fixes, and don't share the public's rising concern that the system is rigged. This book has shown the various ways such divergences have played out. A phalanx of donors has helped put any number of economic ideas on the political agenda in recent decades that are unpopular with most Americans, like reducing taxes on the wealthy, cutting Social Security, and prioritizing deficit reduction over job creation. Likewise, the donors behind the marriage equality movement, operating far out in front of public opinion, helped bring about policy changes that would have taken far longer to happen if left up to ordinary voters. Education donors have often polarized debates over public schools with experimental, market-oriented approaches that are introduced in a top-down fashion without community buy-in. The other problem with the pluralism defense of big philanthropy is that these days, it's hard to know what solutions really do have authentic public support. Any nonprofit can say they speak for some group of Americans, the working poor or inner-city parents or coal miners, and hit the fundraising circuit, possibly with great success. Then it's easy to use that money to generate a lot of buzz and momentum. The rise of grass tops or astroturf groups is well documented, that is, organizations mainly sustained by major backers, not ordinary citizens. Nonprofits that draw minimal financial support from ordinary Americans are common these days, as deep-pocketed donors line up behind different causes. While philanthropists like John Arnold talk about a more robust marketplace of ideas, many of the groups that are hawking ideas nowadays, fueled by gifts from the wealthy, would wither overnight if they had to win support from large numbers of citizen donors giving at a small level. The growing dominance of wealthy donors over civil society is seen in data on charitable gifts that I mentioned earlier in the book. From 2003 to 2013, itemized charitable contributions from people making $500,000 or more increased by 57%. At the same time, such gifts from donors making less than $100,000 declined. Those figures aren't so surprising, given that nearly all of the nation's income gains of recent years have gone to a sliver of top households, while most Americans have treaded water or seen their net worth decline. There's been no shortage of analysis lately of how today's vast wealth chasm affects various parts of U.S. society, yet the distorting effects of inequality on civil society remains only dimly understood. Even as the ranks of nonprofits, sustained almost exclusively by rich donors, keeps growing and speaking ever more loudly. Education is one area where it's hard to know which nonprofits have a real constituency. Reform funders often argue that they're empowering minority parents in the face of entrenched bureaucrats and teachers' unions. And there's now a pretty loud echo chamber of parent groups calling for more charter schools or questioning teacher tenure. Yet, if you follow the money, you'll find that some of these groups rely heavily on just a handful of funders. Take the Black Alliance for Educational Options, a pro-charter school group that says it pushes reform policies that empower low-income and working-class Black families. In 2014, nearly half its annual revenue came from just one funder, the Walton Family Foundation. Or consider Parent Revolution, another activist group largely financed by funders like the Walton, Broad, and Arnold Foundations. Do either of these groups really speak for parents? It's hard to say. In an earlier era of civic life, you typically could only mobilize money if you really did speak for real people and got them to pay dues. As the sociologist Theda Skocpol has shown, mass membership groups were once the most powerful players in civil society. That has changed in an America awash in new philanthropic dollars and where checkbook activism is pervasive. A civic world once centered in locally rooted and nationally active membership associations is a relic, Skocpol wrote in 1999. Vital links in the nation's associational life have frayed, and we may need to find creative ways to repair those links if America is to avoid becoming a country of detached spectators. In the years since Skocpol penned those words, though, things have only gotten worse. Power in civil society has become more concentrated in the hands of the wealthy. In turn, that clout is shaping how public debates, large and small, unfold, as well as policy outcomes. How many very rich people need to care intensely about a cause to finance megaphones that drown out the voices of everyone else? Not many, given the resources they can deploy. The Iran debate showed how just a few wealthy supercitizens can crank up a whole new infrastructure to wage policy warfare, leaving the rest of us to watch these gods throwing lightning bolts at one another. Battles like this will only become more common as new mega donors arrive on the scene with big ambitions to shape society. We're fast moving toward a future where private funders, not elected officials, and the citizens they answer to, choreograph more of public life. A better balance. What, if anything, can be done to stop the further erosion of civic equality in an age of big philanthropy? This is a tough challenge because it pits two important American values against each other. Along with egalitarianism, we also care deeply about freedom, and especially the freedom to express oneself in civic life. Even more specifically, there's long been consensus around philanthropic freedom, the idea that government should only minimally regulate civil society and how Americans use their money to support different causes. In recent years, the Philanthropy Roundtable, which was started by conservative foundations in the 1980s, has offered some of the most robust arguments in favor of philanthropic freedom. It argues that civil society is an extension of our deep belief in freedom of association, and that private charitable dollars are a key to ensuring that freedom. The Roundtable and others see a robust civil society as an all-important counterweight to the power of the state, and it's precisely because it plays this role that we can't let government meddle with the lifeline that keeps this sector strong and independent. Rethinking philanthropic freedom is a Pandora's box that almost nobody wants to open. Nearly every foundation and nonprofit trade group is dead set against any new restrictions on giving for policy and advocacy, while progressives, the usual critics of money's political sway, have their own reasons for staying silent, given how dependent their organizations are on philanthropy. I get these concerns. But it will be hard to stop a further erosion of civic equality without putting some new curbs in place on how the wealthy can use their charitable dollars to shape public life. Yesterday's mantras about philanthropic freedom and the dated regulations that uphold it are out of step with a new set of challenges arising in a second Gilded Age. The charitable tax exemption was created a century ago, and the last big regulatory changes to philanthropy were made in 1969. Since that time, though, nearly everything has changed in terms of how private funders wield influence, and the pace of change has notably accelerated in just the last decade, with even bigger changes on the horizon. Now, it